Our evening program will be led this evening by our brother Mark Vincent from the Lapworth UK Ecclesia. And our brother's title this evening is The Old Testament and Ancient Myth. We'll now bring up our brother Mark Vincent.
So we're doing something a little bit unusual tonight, a little bit different. Normally when we have talks like this, we open our Bibles together, don't we? We look at a passage and we study it to see what it is that God is saying to us. And that's what we usually do. That's what most of my talks are like too. But today is something a little different where we step outside the Bible, as it were, and look at what it is and what it records and compare that to things that were believed, practiced, and taught by some of the nations around Israel, such as the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Canaanites, the various different sorts of Canaanites, and so on. Now, why would we want to do that? Well, it is interesting, I think, because I think so. You may not think so, but we'll see at the end of the talk. It's interesting because, well, for me, I hadn't really thought about the differences. So I knew from being a boy, I knew that God had established the covenant of circumcision with Abraham. But I never really wondered, I wonder if there are any other cultures that practice circumcision. Well, I have since wondered that and read about it, and it turns out that there are. So, you know, there's some cultures that circumcised and some cultures that didn't. So the act of circumcising of itself isn't what is distinctive about the Old Testament. But it turns out that the reason for doing so is completely unique. And there are other examples where we may have a preconception or a thought about, you know, what Israel did was different to the other nations, but we might be mistaken about the nature of what that difference is. And hopefully tonight we'll be looking at some of those differences. So we will find real significant differences between Israel and the nations, which is exactly what we would expect to find if the Bible is uniquely the Word of God. But we won't necessarily find that the differences may be exactly what we were expecting. So that's one reason why we would look at this topic. The other reason is a reason of apologetics, which isn't, as you know, is not about apologizing for your faith. It's about defending it. And it's wanting to have a clear understanding of what it is that is special about the Bible. It's become popular, I would say, in academic scholarship, and that then filters its way through into BBC documentaries, National Geographic documentaries, things that you read in people's blogs or find who knows where on the internet. It's become popular to say, look how similar what the Jews did, what the Israelites did, is to, you know, what was going on in Ugarit or what the Mesopotamians were doing, you know. And there is, that could be done neutrally or it could be done with an agenda. And the agenda could be, oh, you thought the Bibles were special, but actually these other cultures are doing something similar. So it's not so special, is it? And I think you can sense that agenda, at least in some of the popular media, and you can sense that agenda in scholarship to some degree, where there is a desire to pull the Bible into the group with everything else, you know, so that it's not seen to stand out. The Bible does stand out, and this talk is about exploring some of the ways in which there may appear to be superficial similarities between what the Israelites were doing and what some of the nations around were doing, but there were fundamental differences underneath, and we want to try to uncover some examples of those. So just to expand that, I've given the example of circumcision. It may be, the Israelites were not the only people who were offering sacrifices. The Israelites were not the only people with a building of worship, you know, like the tabernacle or the temple, and there may be some surface similarities between some of those. They were not the only people with a narrative about creation or a narrative about the flood. So in what sense then are those similarities there, and in what sense are there differences? So I hope that makes sense as an objective, and I hope that makes sense as you know, a reason why we would explore this. This is not, you know, this material is not something that you, in quotes, need to know, but I think it is interesting, and as I say, if it's not, hopefully the talk won't be too long. Let's just step out of all that for a second and imagine that we were in a world in which aliens existed and an alien were to come down to Earth and were to observe you as a Christadelphian and to compare your behavior with the behavior of, oh, let's say, a Catholic or an evangelical Christian or even an atheist or someone from a different religious tradition altogether, and to look at your behavior, and they were to see you go out of your house, get into your car, drive to the supermarket, let's say Stop and Shop, or the one I always want to say, which is Piggly Wiggly, because I can't really believe that you have a supermarket that's called that. And then, you know, you go and buy your sausages and your vegetables, and you come back and you make breakfast and you sit down and eat it with your family. Now, it's perfectly possible to believe that the Catholic or the evangelical Christian or the atheist might do exactly the same thing. And the alien might be excused for thinking, on observing those behaviors, that there's nothing to see here. These guys are all just the same. But of course, each one of you, of that set of people that I've just described, would claim strongly that they're not the same, right? That there are significant differences between, you know, for the atheist, his or her atheism matters to them in many cases, and of course, our faith matters to us. So the reasons why we do things might be very different, and certainly our worldview would be very different, wouldn't it, amongst those different examples that I've enumerated. And in a way, this subject is a little bit like that. There could be surface similarities, perhaps when we don't know so much about it, but when we look deeper, certainly in every case that I've had cause to consider in, you know, in the various Old Testament studies and books that I've read over the years, whenever it looks like there's something that seems a bit similar, when you explore further, there's actually really interesting and illuminating differences. Having explored, having sat with our alien friend for a moment, let's now leave the alien behind, and let's just think for a minute about those other cultures and what they believed. Let's think for a minute about how myths and polytheistic religions, so almost all the cultures, I think probably all of the cultures around Israel, believed in multiple gods. Let's think what the world looks like from their perspective. So we're taking out the true God for a minute and just imagining the world if you are a Canaanite or if you're a Babylonian or an Egyptian. Why do any such people have myths? Why do they have, creation stories? Why do they carry out magic rituals and incantations and sacrifices and all of those things? Well, it's usually said, and I think this is fair enough. The world is a confusing and a disturbing place, isn't it? And as a human being living in it, particularly in the ancient world without all the modern technology we have today, life is easily disrupted. So whether or not the rains come and the harvest is good in any particular year makes a massive difference, doesn't it, to me and my family and my village and my community. It could be the difference between life and death. Whether or not I have good relations with the village next door, or whether an invading army comes by to attack, makes a big difference, doesn't it, to the life that I lead. I imagine that I'm a single guy again, and I see some girl, and my life is completely disrupted by that. How do I explain all those things? How do I explain the ups and downs of life? What it is to fall in love, or what it is to have a difficulty in a relationship, what it is to have a child that dies, what it is to have a harvest that doesn't come, what it is for there to be a hurricane, all of those things. And as human beings, we want to try and rationalize those things. And so myths are told about this otherworldly realm, this realm of the gods, which is somehow linked to my world, and through which I hope I can influence nature. So maybe the harvest didn't come because, the rains didn't come because there was a god of rain and he was busy doing something else, or I didn't offer him the appropriate sacrifices. And therefore, if I can appease that god, or if I can make that god happy in some way, maybe I can influence things to make sure the rains come next year. Maybe I can tell a story about this other world that will explain how nature is behaving, and that I will be able to somehow manipulate nature to work for me and make things better in my family's life. Does that make sense? So I'm just going to skip past this slide because it's a bit boring. So here's our three realms then in this world of myth. So there's the human world in which I live, but my world is very dependent on the natural world, isn't it? Because it's an agrarian, is that the right word? It's all based on whether things grow or not and whether we can eat and survive. So my relationship with the natural world is crucially important. And so I make up myths and stories and carry out rituals in relation to this other world. And it's not a world in specific space and time. It's this, like, this other realm, that realm is somehow connected and somehow influences and helps explain my world. And the reason why I do all that is to try to preserve the status quo, to make it so that it's just a normal year where nobody dies and where the harvest comes and we eat and we manage to, have a reasonably successful existence, and we hope and pray and say our rituals so that hopefully next year is like that too. So that is the world of myth. And we could say then to ourselves, well, is that anything like what the Bible is like? And the answer is no. The Bible is completely different to that, because in the world of the Bible, there is not this otherworldly realm of many gods having adventures of various kinds. There is one God and Father of all, isn't there, who is supreme in every sense. He's not battling it out for supremacy with other gods, and he is in control of everything. And his actions and the things that are recorded in the Bible are not things that happen in some otherworldly realm. They are things that happen here on earth with God's people at literal places that you can literally go to with literal people who existed in history. And those things happen at specific points in time, and those points of revelation are unique, aren't they? You know, there was only one crossing of the Jordan, like we were thinking about this morning in that manner. There was only one exodus out of Egypt, wasn't there? And it was a thing that happened at a particular point in time in which God reached into the world and did something unprecedented and unparalleled. That is what the world of the Bible is like. Now, I want at this point to make an acknowledgement, and that is to this book, which I read a few years ago now, The Bible and the Myths, by a chap called John Oswalt. He's an Old Testament scholar. I think he's a Christian of some denomination or other. He wrote a big commentary on Isaiah and various other books of the Bible. So before I read this book, I felt like I had some of the pieces of the jigsaw. You know, I understood how circumcision was different and various things, but I hadn't sort of made the connection about how the whole system of the Bible is systematically different to that world of myths that we've just been describing. And John Oswalt sort of puts those pieces together in a way that I found quite helpful, and gives us a framework for thinking about that. And so what it is then is that the Bible is not concerned with, merely with keeping the status quo, is it? with establishing an orderly and functioning society in which they can all live happily ever after. We saw this morning how the Bible is not like the British Airways "Don't You Ever Change" mark. It's not like that, is it? It's about driving change in people's lives and bringing about a newness of life. Whereas the myths establish or seek to establish a status quo, seek to explain things in the world, and then just hold on to that through time. And in the Bible, human choices and behavior matters and are provoked by God. We'll just take one quotation. This is the only one from this book that hopefully just goes over some of the stuff I've just talked through again and just helps reinforce it. Myth is a form of expression, whether literary or not, whereby the continuities among the human, natural, and divine realms are expressed and actualized. By reinforcing these continuities, it seeks to ensure the orderly function of both nature and human society. If this definition is accepted, then it must be abundantly clear that whatever the Bible is, it is not myth. It is not a question of the Bible being true and myth being false, or vice versa, nor it is a question of the Bible's using historical symbols while the myths use nature symbols. What he's saying is that the Bible is just in a different world in terms of what it's seeking to achieve and how it works and the God it describes. Second paragraph here. The fact is that the Bible has a completely different understanding of existence and of the relations between the realms. As a result, it functions entirely differently. It is a rehearsal of the non-repeatable acts of God in identifiable time and space in concert with human beings. So not in a separate world, but in this world, God acting acting within the lives of human beings. Its purpose is to provoke human choices and behavior through the means of memory. So, you know, we remember, we study together, Joshua and the Canaanites and Philip and so forth, and from that we learn how to live. Nothing could be further from the purpose of myth. Okay, So let's just take some examples of that then. So this is what myth is like. So this we're going to look at now a couple of bullet points that describe what the world looks like from the perspective of the nations around Israel, which is going to help us understand more clearly how the Bible is different. So, of course, the cultures around believe in many gods. And these gods are not like our God, are they? They're not the all-powerful creator who has no equal. They're kind of like large-sized human beings, really. They are interested in survival, dominance, comfort, and pleasure. Guess what? They're interested in the exact same things that we're interested in as human beings. They're gods in our image, aren't they? They're just like large-sized humans, and we tell stories about their comfort and their pleasure-seeking and their desire for dominance to explain our own. That's not what we're looking to do here, is it? We're looking for salvation, not just to explain what human nature is like. The world of myth is all about the present. So the things that are described in myths, they're just in this other world. They're not particularly tied to any particular time in history, and there is no particular direction to history. There may be a kind of a cyclical system in which, oh yes, we've seen that before, and in a few years that'll come around again. But there's no direction, such as we believe that God has a purpose to fulfill his promises and to bring about the kingdom. And the conflict is very important. So the troubles that we experience as human beings in the world are explained through conflict and principles of conflict and chaos, and conflict is seen as the source of life. And I think it's pretty easy for all of these points to see how different we are. Nature is sometimes worshipped, so and there's this You know, am I worshiping the tree or am I worshiping the God that supposedly the tree, you know, represents or embodies in some way? It's a kind of a blurred distinction. And there's this big focus on fertility and potency, the use of magic and ritual to try and manipulate the gods to do what I'd like them to do, and a low view of humanity too. So I'm not really empowered if as a Babylonian or an Egyptian or a Canaanite, because I am a victim of whatever struggles or adventures the gods have got going on at the time. Do you see that? That's pretty dispiriting, isn't it? To believe that. And yet that was the default belief. And there is no single standard of ethics, because you've got so many different gods, you can always find a god that, you know, who can justify your behavior in some way. Right? Which is enormously convenient, isn't it? You can see why these religions might have some popularity to them. And so we can look at that and say, yeah, okay, interesting. It does strike me that the last couple of points do have some resonance with the culture of our time today, this low view of humanity. So one of the things we've been talking about with the teens is how under the world of atheism and under the view of some scientists, human beings actually have very little agency, because so much of their decisions is seen as being controlled by their DNA or being controlled by, you know, their socioeconomic background and you know, psychological factors of, you know, well, I couldn't help it. It's just my DNA, you know, or it's just the way I was brought up. And of course, we do know those things have significant influence, but we believe that we have free will and that human agency is real. And of course, again, you don't need me to tell you that there is no single standard of ethics in the world at the moment, and everyone does that which is right in their own eyes. So this world of myths, in which, you know, you tell yourself whatever story makes you feel better just to get through the day. And, you know, you do whatever you want as long as it doesn't bother me. It's not that dissimilar, is it? When, of course, we look at the Bible, we find all these points are contrasted. God is one. He is a God of real character, which we can admire and aspire to. A God of mercy and truth. A God of faithfulness. A God who makes promises. There is no conflict in the creation process in Genesis 1, as we saw earlier in the week. The idols are to be broken. Nature is not to be worshipped. And God is not to be represented in any form because of his utter otherness to the things that are made. The spiritual is more important than the natural. We do not bow to what is natural and base and instinctual. We try to seek to rise above that. There is a high view of humanity in which your choices and my choices are real, and we are accountable for the choices that we make. Our behavior matters. Sex is obviously, there is no sexual aspect to religious practice in the Old Testament, which is completely contrasted to how things were in the origins, in the religions round about. Of course, sex has deep symbolism, but that's a different matter. And history matters. What God did in the past with Abraham and Israel and Moses and David and so forth, that matters. It changes everything. My conduct matters, and there is a future to look forward to. So we've thought in quite conceptual terms, haven't we, about what myth is like and what Bible faith is like. And we've thought about sort of doctrinal differences then and consequences from that. And we can now take that into specific examples that we find in the Bible. So Is that seven? Yeah. That's seven examples of aspects of the Old Testament which it is often claimed are similar to either stories that the cultures around were telling or practices that the cultures around practiced. We don't have time to walk through all of those. We're just going to look at four. The law codes, some aspects of the law of Moses, and we'll do that one very quickly. We're going to think about the creation accounts, how Genesis compares to one of the Babylonian creation accounts, and then we're going to talk quickly through circumcision and sacrifice. So we're going to see how each one of those four, the Bible is different to the world of ancient myth and practice. And then we're going to conclude with one verse from the New Testament that I hope brings things round to discipleship today and relates to this. So what about the law codes? So the cynical claim says, well, I can look through the law of Moses and I can find some laws that I can also find in other ancient Near Eastern law codes. So the law of Moses seems to be just another version of them. But in fact, the law of Moses is very different in significant respects. And one respect is that the other law codes are usually codes where one king or power takes over another and then subjects it to its laws, or subjects an elite class of, you know, sort of civil servant types or priests or something to a certain set of laws. The law of Moses is not like that. The law of Moses arises from God liberating his people from slavery. By grace they are saved from Pharaoh, and then he makes a covenant with them and gives them his laws. And those laws are not for an elite class, and they are not laws just about religious matters or just about civil matters. They are laws that encompass the whole of life, that encompass loving God and loving your neighbor. And that is all one, because both of those things matter. Loving God is central, and loving your neighbor is central. And even if you are the humblest of workers or of people in that society, in Israel, you are cared for and looked out for by the law, and behavior is expected of you, and how you behave matters and has consequences. That again is different to how things were under the ancient law codes. So often under those cultures around, the motivation was, you do this or else this is how you'll be punished. So often in the law of Moses, the motivation is, I am the Lord, isn't it? That he is a holy God, and therefore we seek to emulate his holiness, and that what he is as God is sufficient reason of itself to motivate us to do something. Not just because, you know, I might get however many lashes if I don't do it, but because what he has done is so immense and who he is so to be admired that would motivate me to keep this law. That is different. That is special. That is unique. So that's a little complicated one, because there are a few elements of how the law of Moses is different to the cultures around, but hopefully that gives you a flavor of it. Let's now talk about the creation account. So what we're doing now is we're comparing Genesis 1 and 2 to one particular, let's just choose one particular one. You've probably heard of this one, Enuma Elish. And here's a quotation, a typical sort of quotation that you'd find from a scholar in a commentary. Biblical tradition aligns with the traditional tenets of Babylonian science. And, you know, when you just read a sentence like that, it's kind of hard to argue with it, isn't it? And you just sort of feel, I don't feel very comfortable about that. I don't really feel that ought to be true. And I don't really have the apparatus to know whether it is true or not. But this guy is a scholar, so, you know, it can feel uncomfortable disagreeing with it. So this is standard fare, that sort of quote. And you see what he's saying is, what you're seeing here, you know, it's not so special. It's just kind of like what the Babylonians said. So what we're going to do for a couple of minutes is say, well, is it really like what the Babylonians said? And this example comes from the Oswalt book that I mentioned, and I think it's a really nice example. So if we were to read Enuma Elish, and I did read it once in university, and it wasn't particularly fun. But this is what we would find. We would find that the first 160 lines of it describe the emergence of gods from chaos and Tiamat's plans. So Tiamat is the sea monster. Tiamat's plans to kill them. Now, remember, supposedly, Genesis 1 and 2 align with the Babylonian accounts. So do you see anything in that bullet point that sounds like Genesis 1 and 2? Absolutely nothing. So in the first 160 lines, we found no resonance whatsoever between these. In the next 130 lines, Marduk is selected as champion of the gods. Do we find anything like that in Genesis? No. Okay, moving on. The reasons for Marduk's supremacy are now described in the next 138 lines. Anything like that? No. Genesis 1 doesn't even bother to describe God's supremacy, does it? Because it's like it's so self-evident from the things that are happening. It's not like God has to posture about to justify himself in some way. The thought of that is like so anathema to what's going on in Genesis, isn't it? The next 134 lines describe the destruction of this sea monster, Tiamat. Again, there is nothing like that. Now here at last, in five lines, we find something that could be argued to be a parallel. Tiamat's body, so we've got this, long sea monster-y thing, and we now split it in half, and we make the heavens and the earth out of it. We make the upper waters and the lower waters. So, of course, there is something in Genesis about the separating of the waters, and there is a reference to the deep. And some scholars have said, "Oh, the word deep, the word tahom, is a parallel to Tiamat." Other scholars have argued actually that's a false derivation, and certainly the deep in Genesis 1 is not at all a sea monster, is it? Whose body is split into two. So really, the supposed parallel is like one of the weakest parallels I've ever seen, I would say. Then we have the placement of the gods in the heavens. That's described in the next 27 lines. That's specifically contrasted in Genesis, isn't it? There are no other gods, and all we have are the greater light and the lesser light, and he made the stars also. So it's almost like the exact opposite of what you've got here. And then this is an interesting bit at the end. We then have a broken tablet of Enumerelish, and this broken tablet is now, which is all we've got left, this is the whole of Enumerelish on this slide represented in these bullets. The broken tablet, which we can't actually read properly, is assumed to be parallel with Genesis, even though we don't actually know what it says. it's like you couldn't make this up, could you, really? And Marduk makes man from mud and blood. So again, yeah, there's a slight parallel as God forms Adam from the dust of the ground, but it's not the same, is it? And again, there is reconstruction involved in assuming that there is a parallel at all. So what the guy Spicer, who's the guy who's quoted at the top there from his famous Genesis commentary, biblical tradition aligns with the traditional tenets of Babylonian science. How many out of 10 would you give him for that sentence, for the truth of that sentence? That's a pretty low score, isn't it? I don't think he's passing that test, for me at least. That's all we need the slides for. Tonight, except that I need to remember what my other two examples were that we were going to talk about. So I will just see that. Yeah, we're going to talk about circumcision, and then we're going to talk about sacrifice briefly, weren't we? And that was going to be our set of four, and we're okay for time. So circumcision. So we've established that there were some of the other nations around that circumcised and some that didn't. So circumcision itself is not unique. Why did those other nations circumcise? Well, as far as we can tell, it was something that was done around puberty, and it was a rite of passage to mark the transition from being a boy to being a man, right? And it was supposed to be like a pruning rite to make you more fruitful, you know, to make you bear seed as a man. And you can kind of see how that works as a concept, can't you? And then we say, well, is that like, so circumcision was the Jews then were commanded to do that. Abraham was commanded to do that. Is that anything like it? Well, no, because it was done at a completely different age, wasn't it? It was to be done by Abraham and his family at the age that they were. But then it was to be done on the eighth day. And as far as I know, that is unparalleled. And the reason for doing it is almost the very opposite, isn't it, of this idea of, you know, pruning for fruitfulness. It is, in the scriptures, an act of cutting off the flesh, of denial of human potency, of taking a man and saying everything that you might boast about as a man in pride and what you can do and, you know, notches on your belt and, you know, look how virile you are, is cut off, isn't it? And so God takes a man, Abraham, who we've already established is completely unable now to have children because he's so old, and says, and now take that part of your body which represents your ability to have children and chop some of it off. And it's only after that, after the flesh has been completely denied, after our ability to perpetuate ourselves and in some sense achieve immortality through the ability to be fruitful and have children and live through them, it's only after that is cut off that Abraham, the promised seed, finally comes. Isn't that a wonderful thing there in Genesis 17? And the cutting off, you know, there isn't, it's like it's not this part of our ear, is it, that we're asked to cut off. It's a particular part of the body that has particular symbolism associated with it, which is very human, fleshly symbolism, isn't it? It's that part that is to be cut off. And it is there that the sign of the covenant is to be kept. And it is, of course, in a spiritual sense, with the circumcision of Christ, as Paul describes it in Colossians chapter 2, I think it is, that we too are to mark deeply our own relationship with God in covenant, whether we're male or female, by seeking to deny the power of flesh in our own lives. So, surface similarity, yeah, we can point to some other cultures that were doing circumcision, but the reason for it is almost the exact opposite, isn't it? The creation account is completely different to the other creation accounts. The law of Moses, although certain laws have their parallels, the whole ethos of the law and the balance of the laws within it is completely different. And so we come to our final example, which is the example of sacrifice. So as I've said earlier, Israel were not the only culture offering sacrifices. In fact, most ancient cultures made sacrifices, and there are all kinds of reasons why one might offer a sacrifice to a particular god that one happened to believe in. So you might sacrifice because you wanted to give a gift to your god to show how much you appreciated the god. You might want to try to buy off the god in some way to hopefully influence them to do what you wanted to be done. You might believe that your god needed feeding, and that was what the sacrifices were about. You might believe that your god survived on the lifeblood that came from the animal that you were slaying. You know, the god was, as it were, drinking the blood and absorbing the life. All of those are reasons why, you know, different cultures out there have offered sacrifices at one point or another. Are any of those the reasons why sacrifices are offered in the scriptures? No. Again, it's completely different, isn't it? In particular, people in the ancient world offered sacrifices to try to influence the gods and to manipulate them to which, you know, perhaps that has slight echoes of you know, some of the false understanding of atonement and appeasing God that the churches would have, but they also believed in this sort of layer between the humans and the gods. So there's the gods up here, and there's us down here as the humans, and in between there's this layer of demons that sort of didn't quite make it to gods, but they're more powerful than humans, right? And I might not be able to influence the gods directly, but if I could get the demons on my side, then maybe they can help me motivate the god, and therefore it'll rain and I'll have a good harvest. That sort of thing. Well, what does the Bible do with that? The Bible locates the demons not out there, does it? It locates them inside us. The problem is not some gods not getting on with each other very well, or being busy with other matters in some way, or the demons not having good relationships with the gods, which I want to try to manipulate. That's not the problem. The problem is what's going on in my heart. The problem is human sinfulness. It's that which causes chaos in the world, isn't it? It's that which needs to be addressed. And the whole sacrificial system, in all of its details, of which we obviously are not going to speak now, but they specifically and powerfully and beautifully speak to what our problem is, and how we need to change, and how God will send, and has indeed now, of course, sent his Son to die, that our sins can be forgiven. So yes, there are sacrifices in the Bible too, but there is no other culture that we know about in which sacrifices are offered for this reason. And I just think that's a beautiful thing. We could go on multiplying examples like this, but hopefully those four have given you a flavor that if ever you come across this kind of thing, oh, the Bible is just the same as what's going on in the other cultures, nothing special, then we will, you'd have good pause to say, I smell something fishy here. That's probably not right. And, when we look into it closer, there's, as I say, in every case that I've looked at, it turns out there's another layer of beauty in the scriptures in terms of that uniqueness to them. Now, does this have any bearing on our discipleship today? It's useful for defending the distinctiveness of the Old Testament. The Bible is as unique as we always thought it was. This is just another angle on that uniqueness, if you like. It's just another perspective on that. But of course, this does relate to the bigger question, which affects everybody, of people can do the same things, but they can do them for different reasons, can't they? And we've seen those examples from the Old Testament times tonight. And we had the example of our aliens seeing our Christian and our atheist and our Christadelphian going and doing things that looked similar, but actually the worldview was different. And what matters is doing the right things for the right reasons. And we need both of those, don't we? We need that truth. We need the understanding. But it must not just remain as a worldview, as a thing which we understand. It must be acted out in the real world. And so the passage I'd like us to go to conclude this evening, please, is at the end of James. It's in James chapter 2 and at the end of the chapter. Some people struggle a lot with the question of good living people that are around us. We meet some people who do incredible good works and make incredible sacrifices in their lives who are not of our faith. And it's in a way, it's a wonderful thing to observe that, and we can take example and learning from that. But it's also a sad thing, isn't it? Because we wish that they would have the understanding that we have. Sincerity and works of themselves are not sufficient, are they? You could be a sincere Canaanite but that wasn't enough for God, was it? And God wants that understanding as well as the works. And I just love the way this is brought together at the end of James, at the end of James 2. And my Bible's gone to the wrong chapter. Here we go. So we're coming at verse 23. Abraham believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. So this is familiar territory, isn't it, about how Abraham is justified. Abraham has faith in God. He's justified through faith and by works. You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. And in the same way, was not Rahab the prostitute justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? And Rahab's a great example. We'll look at it later in the week, but she's a great example because she has a confession of faith, and there's the truth that she believed, and she has the works, doesn't she? Just like Abraham did. And so to verse 26, which is the reason we've come here. For as the body, apart from the spirit, is dead, so also faith, apart from works, is dead. Now, if you had to create, let's imagine this verse didn't exist, and did you had to create an analogy or a saying about faith and works involving the body and the spirit, I'm almost certain you would do as I would do, and you would make the faith be the spirit, right? The faith be the thing that parallels with the spirit, and you'd make the works the physical thing that parallels with the body. Yeah? And James doesn't do that. He does exactly the opposite. For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead. So faith then is the body. It's like, you know, going back to Genesis and the Lord forming the man out of the dust of the ground. If God had stopped there and not breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, he'd have remained a carcass on the ground, wouldn't he? And nothing would have gone forward. That wouldn't have been any good. As the body without the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead. So you need the body of faith, and that now gives you something in which you can do works. Because otherwise, if you don't have the body of faith, you're kind of like a disembodied work, aren't you? And it's hard to do works without a body. And unfortunately, well-intentioned and self-sacrificial, good-living people, that is what they're trying to do. And we are grateful to them for the works that they do. Of course we are. But, you know, we should help them find their bodies, as it were, you know, to the best that we can. We have the privilege, through the truth that we know, we have the privilege of having a body. God's given us that body of faith in both senses. And it's now for us to make it live by going out there and trying to practice the fruits of the Spirit and the works of righteousness that the Scriptures reveal to us.